Well, it's that time of the week to devour another week in federal politics with our Friday political panel. Let's take a listen to the way in which the week unfolded.
Standing here as Premier and having the opportunity to call out sexism against women in all its forms, it demands that response.
You don't like listening to women much, do you, Barnaby? I'm happy to let you have a turn and talk about your immigration policy.
Oh, it's about... Oh, of course, that's it. I'm a sexist, of course.
Our party is at a low ebb. It's got to be all hands on deck.
We've actually reached over 1,050,000. And I'm going to target those Labor seats, not coalition.
No, there's no plan to carve up seats, we won't be doing that.
Target the Labor seats.
She hates my part of Sydney, and she said so. People shouldn't pretend to be patriotic if they hate modern Australia.
We're very worried both about the human impact, of course, that comes with war, but also the economic impact.
Minister Butler announced the changes to the NDIS at the press club with zero consultation.
Do you think that the bill should proceed?
No, I think it needs to stop and slow down.
That's some of the sounds of the political week. Well, to analyse it all is our Friday political panel. Mark Kenny is Director of the Australian Studies Institute at the ANU and host of the Democracy Sausage podcast. Mark, welcome back.
Morning, Sally.
We have our very own Tom Crowley. Tom, welcome back to you.
Always a pleasure.
And Sarah Eisen, political correspondent at the Australian, is joining us remotely this morning. Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks.
Now, first off, Foreign Minister Penny Wong and Defence Minister Richard Marles have been in the UK and Europe to meet their counterparts. But in the middle of this, the British Defence Secretary has resigned. What do you think this might mean for AUKUS, Mark?
Well, it's just another one of these problems that seem to come up in this incredibly complex long-term project. I don't think it necessarily heralds any particular change, but it's another reputational hit, I suppose. It's a big reputational hit to Keir Starmer's leadership, of course. I think it's the sixth minister or seventh maybe now, because the junior minister has also quit as well. And this has happened, as you say, while our defence minister and foreign minister are there for those Osmin
standing
talks.
Standing at the aisle.
Yeah. Auckland talks or whatever it is. Yeah. So it's as I say, it's a bit of a mess and a bit embarrassing, and sort of left them sort of kicking gravel around on the driveway or whatever it is that they do when ministers suddenly dematerialise. But in the end, yeah. Look, I don't think it changes much. The trouble with AUKUS, there's a lot of troubles with AUKUS, and there are many problems I think yet to be encountered. But the UK part of it is some way down the track. It's already, behind schedule from what we understand. But I don't think this necessarily materially changes that. Just see what happens if there's a change of Prime Minister. That's the more significant thing, I think.
It is. And Tom, I was saying earlier, we were hearing from John Rentoul, who's a chief political writer for The Independent in the UK, and he was saying, which is true, but it still took me back, he said, of course, it's very rare for a minister to resign on a matter of principle, which is true.
Extremely rare. And we were trying to figure out when the last, how often that happens in our system. I think Julian Leeser over The Voice, probably the last example in our system, although a shadow frontbencher, not a frontbencher proper. Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with Mark that the most significant fallout from this is for Keir Starmer's leadership, it seems, especially given how much his prime ministership has been built on this idea of the defender of the rules-based order and, military presence in Europe and Ukraine, and all of that is so central to him. So to have the entire defence suite exit the cabinet on a matter of principle with Andy Burnham looming in this by-election next week, I'm turning into a Westminster correspondent. But I think that it reminds us that, I mean, as Mark says, the SSN AUKUS part that we need the UK for is so far away, but what is the rise of populism in the, in the US? It seems to have, AUKUS has survived so far, the Trump administration, but in the UK, here in Australia, how do these new characters on the political landscape think about the old alliances and the sorts of programs that were conceived in a very different world.
Mm, yeah, changes in political standpoint and personnel have become an ongoing feature. Keir Starmer's biggest priority might be defending himself over the next week or so. Sarah Eisen, on again, off again, Donald Trump says he's called off further strikes on Iran in the Middle East after negotiations, he's again saying, are getting very close. Does Australia have any diplomatic pull here?
I don't think a lot, really. I mean, even when Donald Trump invokes Australia, our leaders tell us very much that we aren't being singled out. He's talking about, you know, all countries, all allies and so on. And he really, we try to make sure there's as much distance as we can from this, I think, whenever there's a new development in the Middle East. And always we're, you know, hearing from Albanese and the most senior ministers about that there's not going to be any commentary on a day-to-day basis. And like, that's sometimes where that pull can be, is in public pressure, is in people being quite, you know, bolshy and so on. And that's something that the Albanese government has been very, very keen to avoid, and to weather, yeah, even when Donald Trump deigns to mention the country Australia. So I don't think, you know, as a middle power, but also as the softly, softly approach of the Albanese government, I think the pull we have is pretty limited when it comes to this case.
You're listening to Radio National Breakfast and our Friday political panel. Mark, momentum has been building for One Nation. More polling now has put them ahead of Labor on the primary vote. And the party has announced that a $1.8 million windfall in donations. We've seen Pauline Hanson addressing crowds in the West. Will this surge keep growing, or does it hit some point where it falls away? What do you think?
Are you talking about the surge in polls or the surge in money? Surge, or I guess they're polls. Both related.
Yeah, that, well, it's a demonstration of support. We don't know whether it's coming a little bit of money from a lot of people or a lot of money from a small number of people.
Yes, and the history of One Nation's sort of funding windfalls in recent times is often characterised that a lot of money from not so many people. We know that her plane, for example, is provided by Gina Reinhart and some other very wealthy individuals. So, yeah, it's hard to know. We don't have real-time declaration of donations in this country, and it would be good to know if, you know, exactly where the money's coming from and how much there is, and have that verified. And then, of course, as you say, and implicit in your question, is what that actually says about where One Nation is. Mm. It seems to suggest at the moment that, along with those polls, that One Nation is surging. Will it keep going? Will it continue to a higher peak indeed, and can it actually stay there for a whole period of time, up to 2 years to the next election? That's the big question. But it's certainly got both sides worried, and we now see Pauline Hanson, as you played in that opening grab, talking about targeting Labor seats. She even said, not coalition seats, Labor seats.
By name.
Mm. Now, I think at one level that's kind of unsurprising, because if you took every single coalition seat and put it in One Nation's column, it still doesn't get them to a majority with the ones they've got. And so, you know, they need to win Labor seats, right? That's actually the path to a majority. So I'm not surprised at that level, but I think this is as much cultural politics as it is as it is sort of numerical.
Mark, you've been watching politics for a long time. There has been some talk of, with One Nation's rise at the moment, that it will hit some kind of policy reckoning, that as we get close to the next election, if there's not depth with the policies, some people will back away. But are we in a time of disengagement, frustration with the major parties to such a level that even if the policies are not floating well, people are going to stick with One Nation because they've had a gut full of the major parties?
Yeah, well, that does seem to be the trend around the world. That does seem to be the trend behind Donald Trump's victories as well, a kind of an attitude of the status quo isn't working, the system is rigged against ordinary people, and we just want to knock it all over. And so there's a sort of a tantrum aspect to a number of these things, and see what happens after that. It can't be worse than a system that you tell me works, but which doesn't work for me or anyone like me. So it's a dangerous kind of mood in the electorate. That said, I think there will be a lot of people who could be flirting with One Nation who are telling pollsters that that's where they would park their vote at the moment. There will be some of those who will be shaken out of their confidence if they see the sorts of debacles we saw, even with you know, the policy announcement they made only a little, you know, a few days ago, where it just, you know, this is in relation to kicking foreigners out of home ownership, out of property ownership in Australia 2 years. You know, that sort of crashed on the runway, didn't even take off. And if they have more of that going on, I think that's actually damaging for them.
What do you reckon, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I think we shouldn't as well underestimate. I mean, so much is changing in the political landscape, and, you know, you can get a little bit of vertigo from just sort of how quickly it's all shifting. But this conversation about the status quo, I think Labor realises that the one thing that hasn't changed in politics is that voters will still make their mind up on whether the government deserves to be re-elected. And I think that the government understands that, but equally is up against it in, you know, I think you combine such a long period of living standards not really going anywhere in a meaningful sense, and then a housing crisis that has really become the lightning rod for all of that. I think the government understands that, yes, all the anger about One Nation, you know, you're not going to sort of roast them out of existence or kind of debunk a particular policy and suddenly people decide, I don't like Pauline Hanson anymore. But unlike the One Nation and coalition conversation, which I think really is existential for the coalition, I think even when people who don't like the government shift their votes to One Nation instead, that question of whether the government deserves to be re-elected, I think, is where Labor's focus is and on earning that mantle.
Sarah, what do you think? Will complexity and depth in policy, would that get One Nation where it wants to be, or are people highlighting a problem rather than seeking a detailed solution?
I mean, I think the way that the major parties are reacting to this is pretty telling, not just the coalition, but for Labor. What I've noticed this year in the last few months is you've got frontbenchers like Julian Hill and even some more surprising people like Ed Husic saying things like, you know, if you're worried about immigration, it doesn't mean you're racist. And people who work, who vote for One Nation aren't bad people. It's a language that I think is quite telling, because that issues-based, support for One Nation, regardless of that complexity, is something that is quite powerful now. There, it's just such a shift in what we, as a country, as a system, know and are used to when it comes to this. And so the rules of, you know, policy detail and things falling apart up to an election, yeah, that's something that is likely to happen, maybe if we base it on past trends. But I think the fear here is there's so much, unexplored ground and never before seen trends and things that people don't know how to expect. No one can get a handle on who the One Nation voter is. And I'm not just talking the majors, I'm talking journalists as well. You know, we at The Australian, and when we, you know, sometimes we'll write a critical piece about One Nation, the kinds of people who can get in touch are some very, you know, well-educated doctors and so on. And they're really a very diverse range of people who are quite angry when it comes to what they see as the status quo or the mainstream really coming for this new party, this new wave. And all of this, I think, does spark the fear that regardless of a lack of detail, regardless of some of the other less clean things about One Nation, that this is something that has to be taken very, very seriously and could be a threat to the majors and really how things have been done for a long time at the next election.
Sarah, good to have you on the panel this morning. Thank you.
Cheers.
Sarah Eisen, Senior Political Correspondent at The Australian, one of our panellists this morning. Mark Kenny is Director of the Australian Studies Institute at the ANU and host of the Democracy Sausage podcast. Mark, really great to have you back in as
Thank
well.
Thank you, Sally. Anytime.
And likewise, Tom, good to have you back in the studio.
Until Monday, Sally.
Until Monday.